It's Friday, March the 31st, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics Wrap of the Week from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. With me today are Pat Leahy and Cormac McQuinn from our politics staff. Good afternoon to you both.
Hello, Hugh.
Afternoon, Hugh.
Pat, is this how it ends? Not with a bang, but with a whimper, as T.S. Eliot said. Could that be applied to this week's Dáil debates on the ending of the eviction ban, or were there any real fireworks in the chamber?
Oh, I think it was more than a whimper, to be honest. Hugh, there was pretty testy, often quite personalised exchanges between Sinn Féin and the other opposition parties and the government all week, starting on Tuesday with the Sinn Féin tabled a bill that would, had it in the unlikely event of it being passed by the Dáil and Shannon in 3 days, would have prevented the eviction ban from lapsing on Saturday. But obviously that was not likely to happen, but that was the first installment of it during the week. Then there was the Labour Party's motion of no confidence in the government that was taken and voted on Wednesday. Wednesday evening was the vote on the Sinn Féin legislation. And yesterday there was a resumption of hostilities between Micheál Martin and Piers Doherty at leaders' questions at noon in the Dáil. So I'm speaking to you from Leinster House today, and it's been pretty hot and heavy here all week, to be honest. I suppose the outcome of the votes wasn't really in doubt, and the opposition knew that. I think what this week was about maximising the political damage to the government from any evictions that take place over the next few weeks. Now, nobody thinks that there's going to be an immediate tsunami of evictions, but there will undoubtedly be some evictions. You can expect those to be covered widely in the media and on social media. And that just seems to me to be a very bad story for the government, and one to which they will find it very difficult to provide decent answers.
Cormac, do you agree?
Yeah, this will be the key test, you know, in the coming weeks and months, how many people actually lose their homes. And it's telling that it hasn't been terribly clear, even before the government made this decision, how many people would actually end up, you know, homeless as a result of the decision, which is a problem for the government if you can't give that kind of estimate. You know, people are pointed to Residential Tenancy Board figures showing more than 4,000 notices as quit. Government has been keen to say, oh, well, you know, not all of them will end up with evictions. But, you know, it will be very interesting to see how many of these will. You know, even one story of an eviction where the person tells their story in the media, they've got children, you know, is each one of those is damaging for the government. There are likely to be several in the coming weeks and months. So no tsunami, but certainly it will happen, and it will be damaging the government when it does.
Not to be cynical about this, Pat, but you know, politics is in one level the art of performance. And so who performed well, who came out of the performance in the chamber this week, or was it all preordained as you somehow seem to be saying?
I mean, I think the outcome was preordained, but you know, theatre is a part of politics too, and it is, you know, increasingly what parties in Sinn Féin are especially good at this is they will, you know, weaponize moments from the Dáil for distribution on social media. And you will see those things. Obviously, you know, we report soberly and accurately in the Irish Times as soon as we can thereafter and in the following morning's paper. But you know, you will see these things getting huge coverage on social media. And there was one moment, you know, that during the debate in the Dáil during the week, which kind of stood out for me. And it was when Louise O'Reilly addressed Joe O'Brien, who's a Green junior minister who shares her constituency. And she spoke about somebody who's a widow with, I think, 4 children in her, who was facing evictions. And she repeatedly asked, where is she going to go? You know, she's at risk of losing her home. What do we tell her? Where is she going to go? She's told she has nowhere to go. Where is she going to go? And I would be very surprised if that isn't flying around and being shared on social media. And of course, it's not an answer that the government can muster an easy answer to. Now, you know, we live in a free market society. You know, people will move on from tenancies. Some people will be evicted. That's in the nature of the property rights that are protected by the Constitution and, you know, I guess supported by most people. But at the same time, you can see, you know, the emotional reach of something like this. And I just think this is it's a very difficult position for the government to be in. And if I was in the opposition, I would be reasonably happy with how the week played out, you know, in the knowledge that they weren't going to defeat the government in the votes. But if you accept that, I think it's been a good week for the opposition and a bad week for the government. And I think there may be more bad weeks to come.
Yeah, we suggested on the podcast last Friday, Cormac, that this could end up, this period now leading up to and through the ending of the eviction ban, could be seen as a kind of a hinge point, a pivot point in the history of this coalition government, a sort of perhaps even the start of a downward path.
Sure. I mean, unless the government can show real progress over the next 2 years that it is tackling the housing crisis, properly ramping up delivery, they're in real trouble in the next election. And it's going to be such an easy issue, the events of the last month or so, for the opposition to point to as a turning point or as a particularly good illustration of a moment that the government has failed in its attempts to resolve the housing crisis. It's very easily understood by the public. It'll make great clips for election broadcasts and as Pat says, social media. We can be sure they will be replayed in 2 years' time at the time of the general election, particularly if, you know, the government fails to make serious headway in terms of solving the housing crisis. So, you know, it's quite possible in years to come it will be seen as a turning point. There was some suggestion during the week it could be on par with, you know, when Fine Gael tried to slap extra taxes on children's shoes and things like that. You know, I don't know if it will have the same, you know, resonance in decades to come, but certainly when the election is here, 2025, it's easily remembered by the public.
Yeah, I saw that comparison being made along with, I think, going even further back, Ernest Blythe and the widow's pension in the 1920s was the other one. The other point, Pat, is perhaps a less important one, but a point all the same, is that, I mean, you mentioned the Sinn Féin motion and the counter motion, but the actual motion of confidence was tabled by the Labour Party. Its first motion of no confidence in a government in 23 years, I gather. Was that an effective manoeuvre by Labour? How did it play out?
Yeah, well, I suppose the first thing they'd say is that Labour was actually in government for some of that period. So even for the Labour Party, it would be unusual to put down a motion of no confidence in government when you're part of that government. But I gather actually one of the reasons that the Labour put down this the motion of no confidence is that they had thought about the legislative route, which was followed by Sinn Féin, but they couldn't get it on the order paper quickly enough. Now, I don't know the ins and outs of that, but that's certainly what somebody in the Labour Party was telling me yesterday. You know, it was striking during the debate that much of the government's responses to the attacks on it was to be, you know, just was to reciprocate Sinn Féin's aggression across the chamber with their own aggression. But to the Labour Party, they were almost, you know, speaking in sorrow rather than in anger and, you know, pointing out that, you know, that they believed that this wasn't the sort of, you know, opposition that they expected from the Labour Party, and the Labour Party long and honourable tradition of trying to do the right thing in government, sometimes at political cost to itself, et cetera.
It was basically a Stephen Collins column, wasn't it?
I think they might have been familiar with his work, all right. But
Heather Humphreys was a disappointed school teacher, was what it appeared to me.
I found myself kind of thinking that, you know, if you were the Labour Party and you wish to, you know, establish an identity for yourself in opposition, because this is what I think they have to do, that is very different to Sinn Féin, that is equally opposed to the government, but distinct from Sinn Féin. I wouldn't have been too disappointed to hear this at all, you know. And if the Labour Party is still held in some degree of odium by many voters for its participation in government with Fine Gael between 2011 and 2016, and whatever your view about the rightness or wrongness of that perception may be, it's undoubtedly true for many for many voters. But, you know, if that is the case, then I guess if you're Labour, you're not too disappointed with the government saying, oh, you guys have changed, you're not the Labour Party that we once knew and loved. So I don't think Labour would have been too disappointed with that. And it was constantly referenced as the Labour Party, as the Labour Party motion, notwithstanding that the, as is the procedure in these things, it was superseded by an amended motion of confidence in the government, which was put down by the government, which is what the Dáil voted on. But it was pretty heavily branded as the Labour Party's motion, no confidence, in the Dáil. And, you know, so I think I was slightly sceptical about the kind of clumsy nature of it last week. But at the end of the week, I think, you know, I think it worked out okay for them.
And can I just ask you a follow-up on that, Pat? Obviously, all parties are looking towards, you know, the beginning of ramping up for next year's jamboree of elections, which we have to look forward to, and they're trying to position themselves for that. But are they also maybe just looking a little bit further as well? Because, you know, if you look at Labour, the Soc Dems, some of the independents, the role of the Greens, however they come through it, and you look at the likely mathematics of the next Dáil, their support is going to be in play, whether it's support for Sinn Féin or for some continuation of the current arrangement.
Yeah, but you know what? Like, parties tend, they do think about the next election all the time, but they think a bit less, in many cases, very considerably less about the formation of the next government. You know, I mean, I made the point dozens of times here before that the selection of a government for this country is kind of a two-stage process that are, and those two stages are obviously related, but they're, you know, they're distinct as well. And one is the actual election itself, and the other then is the period of negotiations between the parties after the election to try and put together a coalition government. And my expectation, to be honest, is that all parties will, you know, 99% of their efforts are preparing for the election and trying to maximise the number of seats they will have, and maybe 1%, you know, looking forward to the formation of government afterwards. In other words, I don't think that Labour have been engaged in a self-conscious bout of post-election positioning this week. I think they're trying to get noticed. Yeah,
plenty of time for that is what you're saying. Yeah, more than enough time for that. We are going to take a quick break just to remind you that if you haven't already subscribed to IrishTimes.com, please do so to read Pat's and Cormac's, and indeed even sometimes my journalism on IrishTimes.com and in the print edition if you are so inclined. We'll be right back after this. And you're very welcome back. Cormac and Pat are still here. Now, Cormac, this Defence Forces issue, it's a terrible scandal. It's appalling. After years, really, of lobbying by women who had bad experiences in the Defence Forces, the report which came out really shows that things were very far from being the way that they should. And a bit of a challenge for the government, or is it sort of outside the political sphere?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's become a cliche to say that when these things arise, oh, it's another dark chapter in Ireland's history, and you know, these kinds of, that's what's often said. But this one is a bit different. You know, it's much more recent that these suspected abuses have occurred. You know, and up to the present day, I mean, the report says that, you know, the, as an institution, the Defence Force is barely tolerant of women at best, which is, you know, We're in the third decade of the 21st century here. You know, it's well past time that those sorts of attitudes should have long since been done away with. So, you know, it's a problem. There's a focus has been put in the last couple of days on what the Chief of Staff, General Sean Clancy, knows about all of this. And he has said not very much, essentially. You know, doubt has been cast on that by various people, including Senator Tom Clonan, who talked about how he was revealing, you know, the bad treatment of women in the Defence Forces, you know, around 20 years ago. So there are present day questions to be asked about this particular controversy and scandal, to, you know, effectively is what it is. And that makes it different from other things of this type that the government has had to deal with.
Moving on, Pat, we're going to be embarking on a more than a week of festivities, or I'm not sure exactly what they are, of the Belfast Agreement. Myself and Fintan O'Toole were talking about the 25th anniversary in our midweek podcast, and I expressed some reservations about...
At great and engrossing length, I thought.
Yes, indeed. I'm sure you listened to it twice. I expressed a bit of scepticism. I have a kind of... I get a bout of anniversary-itis sometimes. I think we do them a bit too often in Ireland, but Fintan, of course, managed to argue me out of that and pointed out the great significance of this particular date. Are you going to be traipsing around to various official events for the next week or so, culminating in the arrival of President Biden?
Yeah, I think that's inevitable, I'm afraid. Yeah, look, there is, I suppose, a lot of the ceremonials will be dominated by the visit of President Biden, and we're still waiting on some of the details for exactly what he's going to be getting up to. I mean, like, to me, I suppose the 25th anniversary is an opportunity to do two things, and I go some way with you on your anniversary itis, and I think it would be useful if we didn't spend all of the time congratulating ourselves, although many congratulations are due to the architects of the agreement and the people who made it work, the people who took the risks for peace. And you remember the contributions of, you know, people like Trimble, obviously John Hume, and people like that. And that is no harm, there's no harm in doing that. But I also think it's an opportunity for revisiting the agreement and seeing what bits of it haven't worked, or what bits of it are no longer fit for purpose in the changed Northern Ireland that we see today. It seems to me that the agreement has been spectacularly successful in its principal objective, which was to, you know, end the violence and therefore change Northern Ireland. But its success has been much more mixed in the application of its provisions in the three strands, most particularly in the first strand on the internal governance of Northern Ireland. And, you know, the executive and assembly are currently not sitting. They've been out of commission for 9 of the 25 years. And you know, there's a real question as to whether that very, and we've talked about this before, as to whether the very binary conception of Northern Ireland society as between orange and green that is baked into the agreement is now appropriate in a society which isn't binary anymore, which has, you know, a third minority, which is a society of three minorities, that third minority obviously being the Neathers, which finds some of their political expression, but not exclusively so, in the Alliance Party. And I don't know the way around that, and I imagine the mechanics of reforming the agreement would be extremely difficult, but that's not a reason, it seems to me, not to attempt them. And I think that there should be at least some recognition given to the need to do that as part of the whole boondoggle that is about to unfold over the coming weeks.
Now, in a sort of a like-for-like cultural exchange swap, Cormac, while Joe Biden is in Belfast, myself and Fintan O'Toole are going to be in the Irish Arts Centre in New York discussing great matters of state, both in Ireland and in the US. I'm still holding out hope that I might be there at the right time to see Donald Trump do his perp walk to the courtroom in Manhattan, but the odds seem to be against that right at the moment. It's a big, significant moment for Biden, isn't it? I mean, arguably even more than JFK, he's somebody who wears his Irishness proudly on his shoulder. So presumably we're going to be deluged with American TV crews capturing all this stuff, because in a way you could almost read this as the start of his re-election campaign.
Sure. I mean, the Irish-American electorate is probably not as important to getting elected in the States these days as it was in the past, but there is absolutely no doubting Joe Biden's devotion to the old sod, even if the way he talks about it sometimes would raise eyebrows, talking about how he's one of the few Irish people that doesn't drink and he doesn't have any relatives in jail there most recently, you know, kind of stuff that we wouldn't necessarily appreciate, but go down well in the kind of audiences that like Saturday Night Live skits about Irish people, that sort of thing. But yeah, I mean, there is his visit is as much going to be about exploring the roots in Mayo and Loud as the sober important stuff about the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. And, you know, I covered a little bit of his visit here in 2016 when he was vice president, when he visited Trinity College. And it was, you could tell the giddiness with which he felt upon the visit. I mean, in the Grand Library of Trinity College, he kind of came up to the assembled journalists and said to us, you know, if any of you guys see Harry Potter around here, can you tell my grandchildren? You know, so he was delighted to be there and very much enjoying the trip. There's going to be a lot of that over the next couple of weeks, including, I think the speculation he'll do a big speech in the West rather than in College Green or anywhere else. So Ballina is likely to be a big centre of this visit.
Yeah, he'll kind of be the political equivalent of the lovely elderly American tourist who pile off tour buses in Killarney wearing plaid trousers and Kelly Green caps, won't he, Pat?
Yeah, I mean, he does like a bit of the old Turaluralu now. As you said, I think I've heard the Joe Biden Irish American speech on a number of occasions, and I suspect I'm about to hear it.
We're going to be deluged with Seamus Heaney quotes.
Yeah, I think so. But you know, I suppose as a cementing of the Irish American political relationship, and going back to talking about the Good Friday Agreement. You know, I was in Washington recently for the for St. Patrick's Day, and it was amazing, you know, this real palpable sense. Also in New York, where some of the kind of foreign policy establishment is located in various think tanks, the extent to which the Good Friday Agreement is seen as a real concrete achievement of American foreign policy over the last 25 years. And as you know, somebody said, someone said to Micheál Martin at the we met the editorial board of the New York Times, you know. You know, there hasn't been all that many glorious episodes of American foreign policy in the last 25 years, but this is one of them. And that is to the, and you know, that is to the distinct advantage of this country and of the North. So as a price for maintaining that American involvement, not just politically but economically, in the South and in the North. And you know, lots of people talked about a wave of investment from corporate America that could be unlocked if the institutions were put up and running and put on a stable and enduring foothold in the North. So you know, as a price for that, I think we can all, you know, put up with a bit of misty eyed greenness from Uncle Joe.
Now, at this time of the week, we always like to pick a few of our favourite articles that have been published over the last week or so on irishtimes.com. Cormac, what's your choice?
Mine is when Irish Times columnists go to war. We had Eamon Mullally on Monday, I think it was, talking about how cars have to go. She was raising concerns about air pollution and noise pollution in Dublin City and basically advocating for a future where people wouldn't really have cars. There would be very cheap or free public transport, and streets could be converted into green areas and communal barbecue areas and things like that. This prompted a response from Senator Michael McDougall on Wednesday, you know, which was the polar opposite, saying that, you know, car use is not simply the prerogative of the odious and hysterical middle class. And he made the argument that people, you know, they aren't going to take an hour out of their time to bring their children to school on train or on buses, you know, and people can't afford taxis to go everywhere, which is not actually something Eamon Mullally was advocating either. But talking about how, you know, the government's own policy envisages a million electric vehicles on the road, so doesn't that allow for people to have cars? So they both kind of argued the extremes of the two positions. As usual, these sorts of arguments, that the middle ground is probably right. It'd be a good thing to get rid of a few old cars, but also some people do need them, I suppose, is kind of where I came down on it.
Yeah, I do like it when our opinion writers have a go at each other from time to time. You wouldn't want it all the time, but it shouldn't be over-encouraged. But it is good when it happens from time to time. And this one, I think I'm kind of with you as kind of halfway between the two of them, probably more favourable to Una's position. But she did seem to be calling for a kind of Stalinist dictatorship to implement these, which I, you know, as a centrist dad, I just can't go along with that. Now, Pat, what was interesting you?
I'm incidentally, before I get to that, I'm more than willing to have a pop at you anytime, and if you suggest it, you know. But there's a couple of pieces that caught my eye on the same subject, which were from Mark Paul, who is our London correspondent, but obviously has a wider remit than that, and he was in Edinburgh for the selection of the new leader of the SNP, Hamza Youssef, and that election was announced on Monday, and on Wednesday, then he was voted in as First Minister. And Mark wrote an interesting piece, which speculated that the real winners in this might be the Scottish Labour Party, which is experiencing something of a resurgence. And what was very evident, I think, from the election campaign is the extent to which the SNP is now kind of riven by splits. And, you know, Hamza Youssef, having delivered the expected victory speech in which he, you know, called for unity and said that he would be, you know, working with the defeated candidates to advance the cause of Scottish independence and the unity of the party, he promptly demoted his chief rival, Kate Forbes, whom he had only very narrowly beaten by 52% 48 in the final ballot. So she has declined to serve. She's retreated to the backbenches. And it seems to be the general expectation that you have a period of infighting is on course for the SNP at a time when it seems to me that the prospects for Scottish independence are retreating. And in this, I think the Scottish Labour Party spots the chance to win back a lot of those seats that it has lost, Westminster seats that it has lost to the SNP when the British general election comes probably next year. And it seems to me that that could have a very strong bearing, not just on politics in Scotland, but on politics in the rest of the UK. But Mark did a fine job in his reporting on it.
Very much so. My piece is a piece by Mark Hilliard, and Mark was writing about Limerick, the beautiful city by the Shannon, and a bit of a spat it got into with Forbes magazine, well-known financial magazine, well-known for the Forbes 500 or richest people in the world and all that kind of stuff. Forbes published an article a couple of years ago about the Collison brothers, young Irish billionaires who I think are originally from kind of your neck of the woods, Pat. They're from Tipperary?
They're from Tipperary.
They're from Tipperary, but adjacent to Limerick. And that beautiful city by the Shannon was described in this article as, I quote, Ireland's murder capital and Stab City. And not surprisingly, this caused an adverse reaction, including from the Collison brothers as well, I think. And the article was swiftly withdrawn. But as part of its, you know, self-flagellation, sackcloth and ashes, Forbes promised to hold a big conference in Limerick. The years have gone by and the conference hasn't happened. And quite rightly, the people of Limerick are up in arms yelling, where's our Forbes conference? And Forbes are going, mumble, 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 we're still working on it. So it was quite an entertaining piece about cultural stereotypes.
I think the Collison brothers have always been kind of diplomatic as to whether they're from Tipperary or Limerick. So I think they lived in Tipperary, but obviously they went to college, went to school in Limerick. And I think one reporter tried to, you know, pin them down and said, look, well, hold on, fellas, you know, who do you shout for when Tip and Limerick are playing in the hurling? And they deflected the question, or whichever one of them was, deflected the question by saying, sure, look, as long as someone beats Kilkenny, it's all right, isn't it? So I think maybe a future in politics for at least one of the Collisons, maybe.
Yeah, on that note, a note I think we can certainly all agree on, we will leave it there for today. Thanks very much to Pat and to Cormac, to our producer Declan Conlon and our engineer JJ Vernon. We'll be back with you very soon after the weekend, but until then, goodbye and thank you very much indeed for listening. The Irish Times Inside Politics podcast is taking to the road this year with a series of podcasts in front of live audiences. The first is on April the 10th in the Mac in Belfast, when we're going to be discussing the impact of the year of elections on politics across the island of Ireland. We would love to see you there and hear what you have to say too. So to book, go to events.irishtimes.com. That's events.irishtimes.com.